My name is Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is Kaya Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Real Lich Hours, the Planescape Torment podcast from duckfeed.tv, with art by Drew Wang and music by Gwen Static.
And in this episode, we tell you what might have been and what actually happened with Planescape Torment.
Yeah, our episode zero. Mm-hmm. We've been gone for a little while, but you could say we're back.
Yes. Here with the new season, talking about Planescape Torment, Gary, I cannot wait.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Starting these seasons is very fun.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of looking at everything. And boy, starting Planescape Torment really does remind you that most games writing is not very good.
Yep.
From a prose perspective.
Yeah.
Like, just good sentences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we put good sentences in your game.
Yeah, very, very good sentences. Every sentence matters.
Yeah, instead of putting bad sentences in,
mm-hmm.
you know, put in some good sentences.
Yeah.
Yeah. New season. Big thanks to Drew Wang. I think I'm pronouncing that right. For our cool new art. It's great. Love mm-hmm. it. And Gwen for our always very good music. Also great. Also love it.
Also love it. Co-signed on those. Otherwise, there would have been changes. Like, oh no, I'm a passenger here. So both of those are really good. And we're going to talk about kind of where Torment comes from before we get into kind of the area by area stuff.
Yeah.
And also just like the context of kind of gaming around it when it came out. And I mean, a little bit about the Planescape setting itself.
Yeah, which is very important. I would say probably most people who are familiar with the Planescape setting are familiar from this game.
Yes.
Before we get into it, though, a couple of heads up about the season. This is our second game in a row with bad combat.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to kind of take a slightly different approach to the back matter. All of that stuff will leak in, you know, combat mechanics and everything. They don't teach the Infinity Engine in schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to focus on main things for most episodes. So planes, factions, monsters. So those we're going to try to appear in every episode. We'll have our little editorial bits, and every once in a while we'll explain something else.
Yes.
But there's a lot to get through in those three things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to leave any of them behind.
Yeah.
Because this is the best setting.
It is such a great setting, and it is kind of inseparable from just the way D&D has handled planes generally too.
Yeah.
Like, it's very weird how this kind of swept, like, Planescape itself kind of swept in and took over that whole sector, and then kind of became just a background for it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sigil is one of the best creations, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're going to play along, we're playing with the Enhanced Edition and with the PST Unfinished Business Mod.
Yeah.
If you want to play along. I went ahead and installed everything on that. Mm-hmm. It says there's a couple of them that are not recommended. I'm not sure why, but I will look. If we run into anything that has a bad scent, I'll look up and see if that was something they did not recommend.
Mm-hmm. I installed everything except for what they didn't recommend, which look like stuff like weapons and things.
There's a weapon in there. I'm not above using the cheater's blade if I need to,
but
you know, this being an old PC game.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, because this is a setting and it's now an active setting for mm-hmm. D&D, we are in the moving target zone that we will probably be in for every show for this, you know, every game for this show.
Mm-hmm.
If we're dealing with tabletop. So, like World of Darkness, some of the things we're going to say, we're going to kind of be hopping between editions. Mm-hmm. Primarily, this game takes place in second edition. That is where I've done the most reading. Mm-hmm. Fifth edition is also cool. There's cool things in that. There's probably a little bit of information poison between the two. Mm-hmm. But it is, so we might say something that is not currently true if you were playing D&D at the table.
Yes. Most of my knowledge of Planescape comes from the second edition. I got that 3-book set and did my flip through and like looked at the factions and stuff. For my, you know, approaching this season, like, I've started just reading everything that I can from the second edition stuff. Gonna be out of date. That is just going to happen.
Gonna be out of date, and then like retconned even within that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a less lore and canon heavy fandom. Mm-hmm. I feel like,
yes.
And because that we're not going to lay down a canonical history, there kind of isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for this setting, the idea for me, one of the things about Planescape is that this is a prompt. Mm-hmm. This is an explicit D&D setting where here are a lot of cool ideas for you to bounce off of. It is compatible with anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Everything kind of exists. So we're going to slop around in those cool ideas.
Yeah.
You know, which is my favorite thing to do on any show, basically, mm-hmm. is have the, oh, that's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Reaction to a concept.
It's adventure hooks all the way. And like yeah. every one of those main things we're going to talk about, the planes, the factions, the monsters, like all of them are just the entire surface area is hook.
Yes.
For things. And then you can bring whatever you want in. Like this is, you know, the multiverse kind of concept is played out, has been for a little while now. This is prior to that. You know, we are talking about different planes of being.
Yeah, it's very different than like traditionally. I think the thing that makes people mad about multiverses is finding the same character.
Yeah.
You know, like getting your Alolan Lady of Pain.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, who has a sunflower reason, yeah. you know, shit like that. None of that.
Right.
It's elemental yeah. planes mostly, but you can go to different parts of the prime, which means you can work this into your Ravenloft or go to Ravenloft from this, mm-hmm. et cetera. Just very, very versatile. It's dimension traveling before in a new, different way than it's usually done now.
Yes. Bringing up Ravenloft there, the status of individual settings and planes has changed across editions as well. Ravenloft used to be a demiplane. Now I think it is somehow attached to the Shadowfell.
Yeah.
Like that kind of shit. You're just going to have to roll with us if we get fuzzy about it.
I will lay this stake in the sand. I do not care about the difference between a plane and a demiplane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of cosmology of the relation of the planes to each other. Mm-hmm. is not the interesting part of this to me.
Yes.
It's yeah. what's on the planes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand the basic concept of the planes, but it's, for me, it is a set of settings that you can travel between.
Yes.
More than it is the cosmology bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the cosmology comes into it, which we'll talk about.
It does.
Yeah, so Torment. Torment is a 1999 computer role-playing game developed by Black Isle Studios, published by Interplay. You know, rest in peace, Rebecca Heineman, one of the founders of Interplay, for Windows. And this uses the Infinity Engine, which is primarily known from Baldur's Gate 1 and 2.
Yes. This is the real-time with pause combat from yes. those. The kind of top-down, at an angle, moving little figures around
yeah.
kind of play.
Yeah. But unlike Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, this is not interested in combat and tactics. Those games, if you can hang with real time and with pause, those games are good executions mm-hmm. of it. Torment is not. And consequently, this game is less interested in it. Combat is largely optional. A lot of times it's discouraged. It's not fun. Mm-hmm. I think the badness of it is often exaggerated. People talk like it's, you know, having your teeth pulled.
Yeah.
You run away from a guy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that big a deal, and you can quick save constantly. You know?
Yes.
But I do think it tops out at tolerable, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to glaze it. So yeah. That's a very different move for this, going from Baldur's Gate 2.
They did. This is strange because, like, they're using the Infinity Engine because that's what they have, and it can contain Planescape within it. But mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of stuff that comes over with the Infinity Engine around, you know, how to manipulate people for combat and stuff. And I feel like it is kind of a weird fit. They just decided we are not interested in making the kind of game that would use this, but it is here anyway, and it very spottily expects you to understand how to manipulate stuff within encounters that are not necessarily very intentionally designed.
Yeah, there's not good encounter design in this at all. And it's a thing where, you know, they came up with the concept first and then used the engine they had, like you said.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also a thing where the expectations of the time of having a certain amount of combat in a D&D game,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was just kind of how it was done.
Yeah.
Here. Want to get something out of the way. There is a popular discourse, pithy saying about this, you know, WAGs and such. They like to say that this is just a visual novel. It's not. It's got mechanics. There's character build, exploration. You're making choices. The different companions you have impact how the story goes. Like, this has nothing to do with visual novels. Like,
yeah.
yes, the combat is bad and you mostly want to skip it. Stats are really important to this. It's going mm-hmm. to determine what the story is.
Yeah.
That you're getting. Just missing combat and having tax cannot be the bar for visual novel.
No, the deletion of the term
visual novel.
the dilution of the term visual novel is a little bit annoying because it ends up being a means of disparagement for things that are text heavy. I think this also gets that because this is literate, you know?
Yes.
Like that, I think, is the thing that they are saying. And we're getting down to annoying people arguing about taxonomy on the internet stuff. Like, would you call Disco Elysium a visual novel? No, there's a bunch of stuff. It is not text boxes presented with branching narrative. Completely different thing. It's systemic.
Yeah. If we're going to disparage visual novels, let's do it for their horrible art style. Like, we don't need to do it for like what they're not. Let's do it for how they look like shit.
Visual novel is a format.
I bet you if you Google visual novel images, you'll get a lot of very similar images.
Yeah, but not necessarily all.
There are exceptions. I see.
Yes.
Okay. It doesn't count because there's a couple exceptions. I see.
You're taking shots at very particular things, which I know. But again, it's the dilution thing, and it needs to be clear. It is not just anime visual novels with titties and such.
Of course, the other ones exist. They're just either end of the bell curve. Is my point.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the most part, you're going to get horrible villain, and it was also a joke.
Mm-hmm.
The reason, the prose in this game is good, this is the poster child for good games writing and has been for like a very long time.
Yeah.
Basically up until Disco Elysium kind of, cinched it. We'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. And it suffers a little bit from backlash for that. It reminds me of the canon cannot be things old white guys wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. Like that's valid in many cases. I understand it. But the fact of the matter is for 1999, this is treating prose seriously in a way that was super rare.
Yes.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is playing in really heady spaces too, that games, did for interactive fiction and stuff. And you have a note about this. This is dealing with really emotionally resonant stuff in a way that just other things that look like this and feel like this just didn't, and then didn't for a long time after this, or it was incredibly rare for something to try and approach this.
Yeah. Rare before and after, even within visual novels, to me, the most literary visual novel is A Mind Forever Voyaging that I played.
Interactive fiction. Yeah.
Or interactive fiction. Thank you. I should have known that there wasn't the Mind Forever Voyaging guy's tits on every panel. Interactive fiction. Mm-hmm. And that's great. It's a beautiful work. I really like it. Torment, the reason why it's not that is because we have reactivity and world consistency. Instead of it just being a story you're being told, you're in a world that is presenting an illusion of a living world with characters that act in ways that make sense. They react to your choices in a way that makes sense with their motivations. You don't know all the consequences of what you're going to do. That is my number one gamer value.
Yeah.
You're one of my number one gamer values. I love reactivity and I love a world that makes sense. I love it if a character does something and it makes sense for them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this game does that by presenting that kind of consistent world.
Yeah. And reactivity within that contains backlash, right?
Yes.
Contains the consequences, getting bit in the ass for something that you didn't know you were doing, which this has in spades.
And that's either a nutrient to you or a poison.
Yes.
That jazzes me off. I get jazzed off from that.
trying to make jazzed off happen.
Trying to make a jazzed off a thing. So what we have are these very lofty kind of narrative goals, and these are achieved, tethered to an engine to make second edition D&D combat work. Second edition D&D combat has problems enough on its own.
Yep.
So there's a tension in this, I think, where the highs and lows are both higher and lower, or both higher and both higher than Bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it doesn't get as bad as Bloodlines does mechanically, I don't think. And the highs are better. Love Bloodlines. Yeah. I think the highs are better. If you can hang with Bloodlines and you can handle isometric game, you can hang with this.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend it, giving it a try, turn the difficulty down, run away from shit, quick save a lot.
Yeah.
And play along.
Mm-hmm. And turning the difficulty down doesn't like change the, narrative choices and checks and things like that. That is just the combat.
It's just combat. They should make it where it changes the narrative illegal. Like if you change the difficulty to low and it gives you a worse version or a less complete version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that should be against the law.
Yeah. That shit sucks. I don't like that at all.
So getting to the basics, you control a character and their companion, isometric, as we mentioned. The controls are originally designed for mouse and keyboard. My understanding is the controller ports work just fine. I played a little bit of the Switch edition.
Yeah.
On this. It's fine.
I want to have the ability, because I tried firing this up on iPad just to see, because I bought it forever ago. And in any game like this, I need the ability to hold down tab or shift or whatever and highlight everything that is interactable, including just look at this NPC and see if they have a unique name like that.
Yeah.
I need that to happen. And I do not think that is an option on the other ones.
Yeah, especially on an iPad, you'd need that. On computer or mouse, you can hover over everything in a room, really pretty quickly. Most of what you're doing is you're clicking on things, reading things, choosing options from really dense and complicated dialogue trees, and making character build choices as you explore.
Yes.
You read an awful lot. This game has 800,000 words.
Yeah.
In it. One of the things I want to pay attention to during this season that I doesn't get talked about that much is that a lot of the prose kind of extends beyond dialogue and narration.
Yeah.
There are items, descriptions, and just names of objects that are very evocative.
Yes.
They do bits of world building here. And this happens right out the gate.
Yes. Yeah. Something that is a ding against this is that everything is in the Infinity Engine. You are doing a lot of your reading down in the little kind of like text readout at the bottom. Mm-hmm. That is fatiguing for as much as you do. That sticks in my craw a little bit coming back to it. And it bothered me at the time, but now it still gets me.
There's a mod that puts it on the right, like Disco Elysium vertical. People in the Slack were talking about. It's never bothered me. Like, one text box is the same to me as another, but that is a fixable thing, is my understanding. And people said that helps with that.
Okay.
Yeah. It could just, that could come down to just how far we set away from the computer, know, or what have you, but that's never got me.
Yeah.
It would get me on Switch because the text is very small.
Yeah. I'll take a look at that mod.
Yeah. In terms of stats, we have the second edition stat spread, same as Baldur's Gate 3. And conventional wisdom says you should put all your points into wisdom, charisma, and intelligence. And this is true for seeing the most content of the game, and you'll advance in levels most quickly. It's what I'm doing because I want to talk about everything in the game.
Yeah.
But a reason that I think this game, a way this game is not played, but I think is cool, that it would be cool to play it, is kind of taking more of a I see what I see approach. My story is my story. I'm not trying to be everything.
Yeah.
Doing a himbo nameless one, you are going to do, you're going to get less overall prose, but you're going to get a perspective on the story that is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
If the story of the nameless one, your main character in this, who does not know everything that happened, is still an interesting story.
Yes. Very interesting, because without all of the context, you are doing incredibly fucked up stuff without the potential to realize it.
Well, and there are also degrees of context too, right?
Like, yeah.
It's a thing where you don't have to have maxed out wisdom and intelligence to get everything. You could have like a stat spread, like you're making an actual character.
Yes.
One of the fantasy ruining things in this, or thing that's detrimental to the fantasy, is that you start out as a fighter and everyone just does 18 wisdom, charisma, and intelligence, 999. For physical stats, not how a fighter would be.
No.
And you're going to get points to put in these stats as you go as well. So you're not locked into the choices. There are many opportunities to get permanent stat ups.
Yes.
For the game.
That feels important. Nameless One starts out as a fighter, but you can become a number of different classes. The ones that I know of that I can just remember off the top of my head, they're like, you can talk to NPCs to become a thief, or you can become a mage. You can become a wizard.
Those are the only two.
Is that correct? Those are the only two. Okay.
Yeah. But you can switch whenever you want.
Yes.
Which is a really meaningful difference and has nothing to do with the tabletop edition.
Mm-hmm.
If you're also doing something you want a wizard to do, be a wizard for a little bit.
Yeah. Also, coming to this, the last time we did Dungeons and Dragons was Baldur's Gate 3, where everything was customizable. Your companions are fixed. You can influence like what you put points into and stuff, but Anna's always going to be a thief, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And you have a choice of which companions you get, but they're all the same.
Yes.
Also worth noting, this is a big thing that I just forgot. You are a specific character in this.
Yeah.
If you're experiencing this vicariously, you're not creating a character. Mm-hmm. It is the nameless one. Character creation kind of happens throughout the game.
Yeah.
But it's more you deciding what history happened mm-hmm. and what that implies about your current
yeah.
character. But you are not making your own little person, and you're making a really ugly little dude. You play as like a little like goblin shit smear zombie fucked up yeah. Ugmo. Like you look like zombie Danzig.
Yeah, you look like zombie Danzig, like imported from the Legacy of Kain series is what you look yeah. like. Yeah. Yeah.
Nishandra has level drained Danzig a whole bunch. He's been cursed many times over.
But yeah, so like at the start, like the Nameless One, because of the conceit of the game and what it is about, you are playing a blank slate that has kind of an infinite number of malleable paths, right?
You're playing an onion,
yeah,
you know, and you choose where you peel back layers. Like it starts off as a blank slate, like any other kind of protagonist, you know, and then ends up being a thing where you fill in and learn the details. Mm-hmm. In a way that's really interesting storytelling. Real time with pause, as we mentioned before, this is the same like Baldur's Gate 2. This is a contentious thing. This is people hate it. Mm-hmm. People fucking hate this. People want to kill this. There are challenges in making this fun, even for myself as somebody who likes this. And we're going to talk about this kind of over the course of the season. But if you need a primer, I would say listen to the first episode of the Baldur's Gate 2. Coverage on WoF. I'm sure we talked about real time with pause quite a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. In that.
Yeah. As the game that most utilizes that. Yes. I guess like prior. Icewind Dale. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like in Baldur's Gate 1. More.
Yeah.
You know, but there's not very many games that use this thing. It's kind of come back.
Mm-hmm.
In a way you can play the Pathfinder games play this way, and the Pillars of Eternity.
Yeah.
Have this as well. It is, again, it is a thing that people who dislike it really fucking dislike it.
Yeah. I tolerate it.
Yeah. I like it, but I don't like it as much as a full tactics.
Yeah.
Kind of system. Like I don't like it nearly as much as Baldur's Gate 3 mm-hmm. or Wasteland 3 or anything that just actually just does a grid and you move people around by turn.
Yeah.
You know,
same.
One thing that makes Torment really special, and we'll be pointing out during the season, is this flips a lot of genre assumptions. Video games, even now, are basically power fantasies. Your character is a messiah, and you are glazed nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start from nothing and you save the world.
Yeah.
And this was super true in 1999. In Torment, that's not true. You're not trying to save the world. You are at the mercy of unknowable powers beyond your ken. No one fucking likes you. You are... Zombie Glenn Danzig. You're motivated just by amnesia at first, but as you start to kind of unravel this mystery, it becomes this nuanced take on what it means literarily to know your past self, the relationship between your current self and your past self, the burden of having a history and reconciling your now and your past,
mm-hmm.
Which is very deeply personal and very like resonant with me.
Yes.
You know, self-interrogative in a way that something like Shenmue wasn't. Like that was also a subversion of games.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It wasn't philosophical.
Right. Shenmue being like relatively low stakes, right? You are investigating something about your dad, but everything is expressed through this small town, kind of living and engaging with the, kind of the underbelly to do fights and stuff. Right. Yeah.
Like that was one way of subverting the genre then.
Very personal scale stuff. Yeah. The degree to which you are simultaneously a huge threat to the powers here, but also a small speck in the grand kind of just overall cosmos is super interesting, the way that they try and balance that, right?
Yeah. It's very Planescape. Planescape has a lot of contradictions. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of things are both, you know, true at the same time.
Yes.
There is a way they also want to subvert mechanical expectations by making your character immortal, have that mm-hmm. be a problem, and then making it be a mechanic.
Yes.
This is not the first time death has been a mechanic before. Mm-hmm. Wario Land 2 had come out a year prior, and that's the first one I knew of, but I'm sure it had been happened before.
Yeah.
Or it happened before, but I had never seen it used as a narrative device quite like this. I don't know of any mm-hmm. game that has done that.
Yeah. You know, like there is a place where you go when you die. Like you don't start the entire game over. Like you can reload if you want to. I think we discourage that. unless something really gets kind of like fucked up, like you die and then you can go back to where you were. Like you just wake up where you started the game.
Yep. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, you travel back. It's kind of a pain to get back sometimes. Mm-hmm. But there are also kind of checkpoint things. There are places you'll respawn later. Yeah. You don't always respawn in the mortuary.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's really neat to take the fail state of video games and making it not only impossible, but desirable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something you want to get back in there. You need to mm-hmm. do things. You have to be dead or be seen mm-hmm. as dead to do things. You have to die to do things.
Yeah. There are incredibly stupid things that you need to do that will require your death to proceed or to get an outcome that you want. This also relates to the nameless one's body. You know, we talk about him as zombie Glenn Danzig. He is completely scarred over, and also effectively a zombie in terms of like his resiliency and how little that matters to him.
Yeah. Immortal in multiple ways. Like he doesn't have a healing factor like Wolverine where he comes back to normal, but you can do whatever you want to him.
Yeah.
Basically, you can like take off his hand, put another hand on there, rim mm-hmm. jobs, take out his teeth, whatever you want, $1,000.
Jesus. Yeah.
That's when Tim Robinson's the character. I don't want to rim job the nameless one. I was letting the audience know that I wasn't trying to rim job the nameless one.
Yeah.
I'm more of an Adon man.
It's the taking out his teeth thing that fucks me up. That fucked me up in that episode.
Yeah. It's a weird thing. Your character does not have a solid class archetype. We talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. Your vocation is fluid, and that makes sense for a character who has done everything.
Yes.
You know, you're not meant to be attached to yourself mechanically in this game. Yeah. This is a game about exploration, exploring yourself mechanically, exploring the world mm-hmm. mechanically. That is why death not being a factor is important, because mm-hmm. you can die to explore.
Yeah.
You know, and your character is not your job. You are mm-hmm. a historian. You are a historian of the self. And anything you need to do mechanically to pursue that is on the table. And the game does a lot to kind of show this off early on.
Yeah. And that's true for your companions as well.
Yes.
Like we've made a lot of hay in the Baldur's Gate 3 episode talking about like, this is a big band of fuck ups, you know,
yes.
that is, you know, in this incredibly dangerous situation, but they weren't really thriving before they were in that. This is the most fucked up cast of, companions that I can think of in games. And a bunch of the stuff that they have is really like, you know, contradictory. You know, your healer that you get is a succubus, right? Like a reformed succubus. Like, you know, no character is their job or can be boiled down to that. They are not just where they came from and what they've done, but like specifically their relationship with the nameless one over time.
Yeah. And none of them stay the same. None of them, they all have something to learn.
Yeah.
And they can all change. This was one of like maybe the original, and it's the earliest example I can think of an absolutely knockout fucking companion set.
Yeah.
Every single one of them I want to know about. Even Valor, the least interesting one. Mm-hmm. First of all, I get to hear Keith David. Second of all, like, I don't know. I want to know about his backstory. It's interesting. You can do interesting mm-hmm. thing with the worst character of this.
Yeah.
I'm going to not be an old man the entire season and compare like modern BioWare games to this kind of shit, mm-hmm. but it does drive me crazy. Like, it was a big thing that made me feel like I was in good hands in Baldur's Gate 3. Mm-hmm. That is not as fucked up a crew, but they each have a thing. Like there's something interesting about them. They're not just like, I'm a guy and I have a tragic backstory. If you put enough points, I'll reveal it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This kind of alienation and subverting things extends to the world building and kind of aesthetics. No swords, no shields, no armor, no elves, no dwarves, no magic missiles. Mm-hmm. Everything is different and alien in a way that explains the world.
Yes.
To you.
Yeah. And that's true of Planescape in general as well.
Yes.
Like there's a big, you know, like... in the second edition book, when you are, you know, like reading up about it, like you learn about the difference between, a planar character and a prime character, and whether or not like all of your party members are planars or all of them are prime or there's a mix, like kind of affects what kind of campaign you can run. And planars are all weird shit. like they are Gith. They are various kinds of demi-fiends and stuff. They are alien because they come from literally across all possible creation, not just whatever kind of small setting you have that is Tolkien-esque.
And these are the raspberry Gith. Mm-hmm. We had the blueberry Gith before. We got raspberry Gith now. The Githzerai.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Who are, to my mind, a more interesting Gith. Mm-hmm. Baldur's Gate 3 making the Gith Yankee interesting is a fucking feat.
Yes.
Planescape, undeniably baller as a setting. This was designed by Zeb Cook, 1994. D&D had always had Planes of Existence as an idea, but for a long time, this was really underdeveloped. We just had one splat book, The Manual of the Plane. But there was demand. People wanted to travel to these different planes. Because of that demand, this setting got made.
The original Manual of the Planes is very fun to look at and to read, because like every single one of these potential settings is like, anybody from the Prime Material will die instantly when they go
there's
here.
There's a lot of once you go to the Plane of Salt, you dry out and become a desiccated, don't do it.
It's just really funny to just go and be like, you know, and not just that, like even the outer planes, you know, the outer bit of the wheel. God, the fucking world models.
Looks really cool.
Any of the ones that are like alignment based, you know, immensely hostile to you, and really kind of implied to be like either this plane is a source for power and a place where monsters come from, or like this is, an exemplar. This is where the powers. This is where the gods of a place live. Kind of inherently implied to be high level campaigns, right? Like prestige level kind of shit. And Planescape, you know, the setting proper does change that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like, makes it accessible. You know, the old Manual of the Planes might as well just said, don't on the front, and it would be basically fine. And it was, the demand came from people who had really high level characters who had done all the stuff they could do.
Yeah.
You know, like we got to go to Elysium because what the fuck else are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, we've done all the stuff. Cook went into making this. He was inspired by influences as diverse as the band Peru Ubu and the movie Wolf Devil Woman. Don't know what that movie is. But he set out to make a comprehensive campaign world fully compatible with the Manual of the Planes, so it did not contradict anything. And this created this setting where even as low-level characters, you could actually visit these strange otherworldly places, not instantly die, when you go to them. And there's enough space for the Dungeon Master to make up whatever stories they like.
Yes.
In this.
Yeah. And there needed to be something to hold all of these together. Like, you know, the cosmology kind of puts the different planes in relation to each other, but there needs to be kind of like a center of planar society, kind of a crossroads that is not just any number of prime materials that you might be on for different campaign settings, or even like individual homebrew kind of things, right? There needed to be a center of the universe, and they had to create it. And you get two things: you get the Outlands, which is its own really cool idea, but you get kind of like the defining feature of Planescape, you know, TM as a concept, which is Sigil. The city at the center of everything.
The city of doors. I love that this was a mechanical concern.
Yes.
They needed adventurers to have a home base while you're doing all this stuff. And how unsatisfying would it be if your home base was Forgotten Realms?
Mm-hmm.
Not only because you've been there, but that comes with all kinds of baggage.
Yeah.
You know, this is more central, and it allowed them to create something from the ground up. And they did just a fucking incredible job of it. It's going to be fun to unpack this. Mm-hmm. I love Sigil so much. It is like my favorite fictional town.
Yeah.
So we have this melting pot where people are coming from all different kinds of planes. The planes are kind of lined with elements or alignments or beliefs. And Sigil is what you get if you get all of these people with all of these beliefs in one location, which led to another kind of hallmark of the setting, the faction system.
Yes.
Where citizens of Sigil, they rally around a specific shared philosophy. Mm-hmm. And because of their collective belief, this literally can change the world. Down to the topography.
Mm-hmm.
You can shift cities from plane to plane. You can do almost anything. You can do that kind of shit in the game.
Mm-hmm.
If that kind of the power of collective, you know, consensus reality is compelling to you, you get to do a lot of that cool ass shit in the game.
Yes.
I love doing that kind of thing. I love the idea of a world where consensus reality mattered, you know, and actually reflected the world.
Yeah.
As a thing, like, it'd be so cool if what most people believed actually was the truth.
Uh-huh.
I know this is the opposite. It's the truth is what most people believe, but I'd take it.
Uh-huh.
At this point, rather than going to this Kafka-ass fucking nightmare.
I would take it compared to the what we have, which is nothing is connected to anything.
Yeah, nothing's connected to anything, and it does not matter what truth is or what is true.
Yeah. So we mentioned the Outlands, which is kind of this place where it's like a big kind of like plains or prairie with a bunch of different realms within it. But like each borderland is kind of like up against one of these alignment based planes or whatever. There are constantly like wars to expand territory, but those are not just, hey, we kill everybody and then take over. Like, you can make a city just kind of like drop off into Beator if you want
to. It's hearts and minds.
Drop off into the hells. It's hearts and minds. Yeah. So like that stops a campaign from being, we just need to kill everybody, to like, what do we need to do in order to stop this city that is dangling on the edge from actually falling in, from, you know, from becoming fully hellified. Right.
And that's really interesting at the table and in this setting, because one of the things about the different factions, everyone believes they're correct. Mm-hmm. Everyone is passionate.
Yes.
When you play this at the table, you're inherently sitting down to play with characters of different beliefs.
Yes.
Nobody's going to want to do the same faction. Like, you could just do like the Dustman game, but that seems kind of boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone's going to want the same thing in terms of that. So not only do you have this different verb set in terms of winning hearts and minds versus just being a murder hobo, other characters might want to change hearts and minds in a different way. The degree to which you are compelling matters. In this, there are a lot of other quirks to the city, a lot of cool things. We're going to talk about those as the Nameless One learns them. Having your character amnesiac in this fulfills a real purpose, other than just kind of being the start of a video game.
Yes.
So, talking briefly about the development, it's really well documented. This is just kind of a crash course. There's a lot of stuff out there if you want to look up more detail. So game designers made a 47-page vision statement. They used it to pitch this to Interplay. This vision statement, if you look it up, you want to, it's not very reflective of the game. Nope. It is kind of infamous for having grody stuff about like getting babes, selling this as a power fantasy. I think this is just 1999-ness, that being in the water, and trying to get the game published.
Yeah.
Trying to say like, hey, this is an adolescent male power fantasy, publish it, give us money, because we're going to make something that will get teens to buy it because they horny, because they, you know, they ran through Virtual Valerie. All used up.
You know, that CD-ROM nothing there anymore.
It's trash. Yeah.
And then nobody wants to touch it with their bare hands.
No, it's gone.
Yeah. Just trying to say, hey, this is going to appeal to the demo that is playing games, as opposed to pitching like, hey, we're going to do this heady existential narrative related to, personal past and self, self-reflection and stuff.
Not saying that the people who did this, there's no skeeviness in them, or they didn't want a little something for daddy. Like, there is a little something for daddy in this game. Like, Anna is very revealing and sexualized in this. This is not above all of that stuff.
No.
It doesn't engage in it to the degree that you would believe from this pitch document.
Right. And it got picked up.
Game published. The original idea was to have three games. In the setting, another PC game, which we don't know a whole lot about, but a PS1 game like Kingsfield, where you played a member of the Harmonium. Imagine a PS1 Kingsfield alike. Set in Planescape.
Yeah.
Wild. Be still my heart. Like, I would love to have seen that. And so we just got Torment, which was originally called Last Rites. There's some primary names associated with this.
Yes. Chris Avalone, Eric Campanella, and David Maldonado.
And the excellent name haver, Guido Henkel.
God, that's so good.
Guido Henkel. It's fun. Say it. If you're at home, say it.
Say it. And these people don't get along very much anymore.
No. Yeah. You know, Henkel claims that he is responsible for a lot more of the game than he's given credit for. He is the model for the Nameless Man on the cover, who is blue for some reason.
Yeah.
But that's him. Quick note about Chris Avalone, guy who I am a fan of, despite what we're going to say in a second. You know, is responsible for a lot of my favorite game writing. There are scumbag accusations. I don't know. I'm not day and date on all the developments in that sphere. The last of my knowledge, and Kay, you can correct me if you know more recent knowledge, is that he was a shitty drunk who hit on ladies. He wasn't holding BioWare freak-offs.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like Chris Avellone has a ton of baby oil shipped to Interplay.
Yeah.
You know, every month or anything like that. He was kind of a creep, but not a pedo, I guess. Like, drawing these distinctions is so fucking the world we live in. But it matters to me, I guess, is my point. The idea of being a shitty drunk and being kind of a lech in the past and not doing it now does not put me off my tee with doing anything with Chris Avellone. But I don't blame anybody who is.
Yes.
You know, and we're not going to talk about that all the time in the game, not least of which because he wasn't responsible for everything in the game. Officially, controversy acknowledged.
Yes. I think that there was something related to a suit that may have been thrown out. I am also not day and date. You know, from my perspective, this is probably the last that we're going to talk about him specifically as we kind of like walk through, you know, the work. This is not a hagiography of the man. And simultaneously, I think that it would be very difficult to talk about history of video games, but like specifically on a show that is geared around CRPGs, it would be really difficult to try and talk around his contribution.
Memory holum. I don't think it's useful to do so either.
Yeah.
You know, it's again, when we assume the people who we like creatively are moral paragons, we set ourselves up for betrayal.
Yeah.
It is a false thought. Also, when I first kind of played this, I really felt like, and conventional wisdom was that he was the primary person responsible for it. This is an auteur theory game in some ways. That has become less appealing to me as I've gotten older. Yes. One of the other reasons why we're not going to talk a whole lot about Chris Avellone is like, I don't know who did what.
Yeah.
I could find out, but the grand whole of the game is what I want. You know, it's not like Tides of Numenera where Chris Avellone wrote a specific character.
Yes.
You know, and you did that backstory. This is messier than that. So it to me, I don't know who did what. And I'm not particularly interested after this point, I guess.
Right. Yeah. We're looking at the work itself.
Yeah. Because this is a good game, it was released in a shitty state, like all good games are. This was Henkel's primary anxiety. Yeah. Interplay initially supported this, but left it kind of linger at the 1.1. Supported after launch. We left it to linger after the 1.1. A lot of good bugs and omitted quest lines were still broken. But also because it's a good game, Miracle fans took it under their wing and fixed a lot of stuff.
Including
two things that happened to good games.
Yes. Including the mod that we're talking about, the Unfinished Business mod, which addresses some of the, you know, stuff that's kind of broken, but also brings in stuff that was, you know, mostly completed but not implemented, I believe is kind of what it does. Yeah.
And several things also got picked up by Beamdog.
Yeah.
You know, working on that fan work. Initially, the soundtrack was done by a Welsh industrial musician named Lustmord. Lustmord created our Lord and Savior of the Dark Realms. Lustmord created over 40 pieces of music. By the last minute, the producers said they wanted the thing to sound more ambient and kind of melodic. So they got Mark Morgan, who is the guy who did the Fallout soundtracks. Soundtrack is really good. I don't know if the Lustmord one would be better. I didn't really want industrial music in this. I like the atmospheric stuff. And there's bad blood there. Lustmord hated the experience of working on this.
They threw out all of his work.
Of course he does. He ended up repurposing some of it for a later project, but like I imagine that being a real slap in the dick.
You can really tell the commonality between this and the Fallout soundtrack. Not the same instrument palette. Like this like feels kind of like world music-y to a degree.
As befits a central location, like a melting pot.
Industrial would have, you know, like there's a lot about Sigil that is real scudgy, you know, and certainly a lot of stuff about the different settings and things that's real scudgy. Industrial would be a strange fit.
I think that there's a real risk of it aging worse.
Yeah.
You know, kind of regardless of what you feel about industrial music, what we have the soundtrack we have feels like Mark Morgan feels real timeless to me.
Yeah.
Because it's not asserting itself very much, which sounds like an insult, but I think like the main themes of this game are great.
Yeah.
You know, it just feels kind of timeless. It's not tied to an instrument palette or any specific genre that can rise and fall.
Yeah. And I'll say it. I do not associate industrial music with the contemplativeness that this game demands.
Yeah. Acadia FM, you know, kill motherfucking Depeche Mode. Not super contemplative, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This game has a really stacked voice tech cast. Mm-hmm. We got Jennifer Hale, Tony Jay, you know, Keith David, Rob Paulson, Mitch Pileggi, who is Skinner from X-Files, mm-hmm. Dan Castellaneta, and Sheena Easton.
Yeah.
Everyone does a good job in this, mm-hmm. But that is ludicrous. That is, you could get all of those names in 1999 for nothing.
Yeah. Just kind of like sweep them up and like all of them are names that you know.
Yeah. And some of them are really video game associated. Like you're going to get a Jennifer Hale and a Tony Jay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Game.
You're not necessarily going to get a Mitch Pileggi though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't always get Dan Castellaneta.
Yeah. You know, things. Like Keith David's kind of right on the border, you know?
Yeah.
Like
he's an outlands. Yeah. to this thing.
Yeah. I do not associate this specific era with his video game voiceover work.
No.
Yeah.
He's a border voice actor, mm-hmm. and he got dragged into away from video games through yes. belief, through fandom.
Yeah.
This game is a cult classic. It's critically lauded both at the time and now. Mm-hmm. Has been called one of the greatest games of all time by many, including myself. And that reception makes a lot of sense when you look at what was coming out in 1999.
Yeah.
You know, again, we mentioned that 1999, great year for games. There aren't bad years for games. I don't turn my nose up at those games. This mm-hmm. is definitely attempting something different.
Yes. Yeah. And it, you know, its footprint is undeniable, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is a good game, it sold like shit. though it did ultimately make a profit. It wasn't enough for the mammon worshiping ghouls who run everything. So we never got a follow-up.
Right.
But we did get a spiritual successor in Exile, who are the torchbearers of the Black Isle legacy, a lot of the same developers, made 2017's Torment Knights of Numenera. We did WAF episodes on it. You can listen mm-hmm. to our thoughts on that. It is good while not being as good.
Yeah.
Is, you know, basically where I land on it. Even down to like the writing in it is good. The individual prose is worse.
Yeah.
The grand theming resonated with me less, but the actual individual prose, like popping back into this prose, this is a lot stronger.
Yes. Yeah. Also, like Numenera is a very weird setting.
Yes.
There and just based on what I have read about it, the Torment game in it does not necessarily act as like a libretto for like the coolest stuff about that setting.
And Numenera is a rough one because it's such an artificial attempt to create like a version of Planescape in a way, like mm-hmm. create a using time to make everything possible rather than space.
Yeah.
And there's cool stuff in it, but it just felt like too obvious of a move. Like I understand they couldn't get the license to just do it in Planescape, but, and if any tabletop setting was going to make sense for it, like sure, that one, but it ends up making it suffer in comparison. It ends up feeling like a pale imitation.
Yeah.
At least to me.
Speaking of spiritual successors, there's also, you know, because there has to be the split, there's a diaspora. My understanding is that Pillars of Eternity is taking, you know, as another one that made some attempts at being Planescape-y, right? I have heard that spoken.
It wasn't my experience when I played it.
Mm-hmm.
That felt more like an attempted to be kind of Baldur's Gate-y. It's a little bit heady, but it's mm-hmm. no more heady than like the Forgotten Realms.
Okay.
I found, but some people might say that shit, but it ain't fucking mm-hmm. true. That could be, I haven't played through the second one. I haven't played mm-hmm. through the 3D one, you know, the game in that world. So maybe it gets more like that. The first game mm-hmm. is not very much like that.
Yeah.
There was a sequel planned, by Beamdog, who were the people who made the enhanced edition. It was going to be called Planescape Unraveled, which is a clever, little bit.
Yeah.
There. And this was designed by David Gator. In the mid-2010s.
So, yeah.
You know, a lot of filling up meters to get sex. This was canceled, though, in 2016.
I don't know the David Gator baggage.
And David Gator is the BioWare, the primary BioWare guy during BioWare's main deal.
Gotcha.
So we associate with a lot of mid-era BioWare.
The Dragon Age guy is what I'm saying here. Okay.
Yeah. Dragon Age guy, and went on to work on other games with the series. He's that guy, though.
Yeah.
He's not horrible or anything. Mm-hmm. Like, Dragon Age 1 is better than later Dragon Ages, but I don't want that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
My characters.
Canceled in 2016. Canceled. Yeah.
Yeah. And Siege of Dragonspear, the one piece of Baldur's Gate content I haven't played, which Beamdog did develop, has a really bad reputation. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is for the best that we didn't get an actual sequel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. We're off. As a structure, I'm going to play a goody two shoes. Kay has to take her turn as the heel. We did the opposite in our WAF episodes. It is one of the hardest gaming accomplishments I've ever done. And now I get to make everybody happy. I get to do a redemption arc.
It's fucking rough. I've only played up through what we're covering in the next episode. Before I've even left the first dungeon in the game, I have done something unforgivable.
Twist the knife. Like, if you play this as a ne'er-do-well, and there's plenty of space in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can play. You don't have to just choose. It's not binary. But, like, if you play this with the worst choices, you do things worse than you do in most games. And they're written with prose that is better than in most games.
Yep.
It's heart-wrenching.
Get in the pillar, Mort. Mort, yeah, get in the pillar.
There's a lot of betrayal of people who only want to believe in you and sometimes are forced to cosmologically to believe in you.
Yeah.
It is really rough. Not recommended for a first playthrough.
No.
But it is kind of if you're one of the people who can't play it through as an evil character because it just feels bad, this is your final boss.
Yeah.
If you can make this, you've done it.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, this is where you do your letters and stuff. We don't have them yet. We're just going to see you next episode with the mortuary. Kay, what can they do?
Well, you can go and check out the other stuff that is available to you on this tier. Well, I guess since this is the first episode of the new season, we should say consider backing us because this one's going to be going out for everybody.
Yeah.
This is a premium show. You can go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. That is where this is hosted and served through. At $5 per month, you get a whole bunch of stuff, the ongoing premium shows, but also access to the whole back catalog. We have two seasons of this show prior, first talking about Baldur's Gate 3, second talking about Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. Similar format, similar approach to CRPGs. We think that they are good work, and if you get anxious and antsy waiting for new episodes of this to come out, you can go back and dive through that back catalog there.
Yeah, and any number of our shows.
Yes.
We have so many. You mm-hmm. get a lot of value for that. You give you more at $10. It keeps the lights on. So if you like this show and you want us to keep doing it, that is how that we do that. Yeah. Ratings, reviews, and sharing this episode with people you think who might like it is also real big. Sharing the preview episodes of our previous seasons and of our other shows. Please mm-hmm. do that. Join us in thanking Gwen, our producer, who also did the theme song for this.
Yeah.
Which is sick.
It's really good work.
Yeah. Great work, Gwen. Drew Wang, if I'm mispronouncing your name, I apologize, and it will be at least a couple episodes before you will hear this, mm-hmm. and I will be able to correct it.
Yes.
The notes are Wine Garden without Arden,
mm-hmm.
so Wang is kind of how I'm doing it, but I'm not sure. But look up his stuff. It's Drew, and the spelling of that, in case you want to look it up, is W-E-I-N-G.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool, really easy to work with, and did great work.
Yes.
So, highly recommended.
Mm-hmm.
And we will we'll see you next time in the mortuary.
I said that made death reject me.